Good morning. You can be opening your Bibles to Matthew chapter 5. We're going to continue today in our series on proclaiming good news or gospeling the gospel. This is part 7. And we've been talking about the good news is that Jesus is king. As king, he has a kingdom. He reigns. The proclaiming good news means that we are invited to apprenticeship with Jesus to live in the ways of his kingdom. As I said last week, we'll begin exploring the teachings of Jesus this week. When we turn to the teachings of Jesus and look at what he taught about regularly, at the core of that, at the heart of that, is teachings on the kingdom of God. Matthew 4:17. This is after Jesus has gone for 40 days in the desert and being tempted. He comes back and he starts his public ministry. And it says, from that time, Jesus began to proclaim, repent, for the kingdom of heaven has come near. Several years ago, I was riding in the car, and our kids started one of those conversations that are always really fun for a parent. Ones that really actually are fun. But they started talking about what they want to be when they grow up. This was when Alex was about 11, so Austin was 10, and Julia was 5. They were talking about what they wanted to be when they grow up, and Alex said he wanted to be a doctor, which is kind of funny now. But he wanted to be a doctor or a teacher or a blacksmith. I guess probably there's a lot of people who are all of those at the same time. But Austin, I don't know where he learned this word, but he said he wanted to be clergy or a teacher. And then he said, do they make much money? I said, no, they don't. Neither one of those. And I asked Julia what she wanted to be when she grew up. She's probably terrified right now. She hates anybody even thinking about her, much less looking at her. I said, what do you want to be when you grow up? She said, a big sister. I was like, so just giving you a heads up, my career choice is lining up work for you. In one sense, miraculous work for you at this point, you know. Several years before that, when Alex was about 4, it was just known he wanted to be a fireman when he grew up. He wanted to fight fires, but one day he said, you know how Mom is two things. She's a teacher. This was before Sue and I were in the ministry. He said, you know, Mom's a teacher and a Christian. Can I be two things too? And I was thinking, oh, he's thinking a firefighter and a Christian. That's awesome. I said, yeah, you can be two things. What are your two things? He said, I want to be a firefighter and an astronaut. I thought, I want to fight fires where there's no oxygen. Brilliant. I'm going to get, as a firefighter, I want to leg up on those fires. So I thought that was awesome. Whatever they choose, they will enter into a process to become that. You're not just all of a sudden a firefighter or an astronaut. Ask Mike Bird about the training and the education and, physical, mental, everything that he's going through to become a firefighter. You don't just walk up and say, hey, I'm going to be a firefighter. You train for it. You study for it. You learn how to become whatever you're going to become. It begins with a choice on what you want to train for. You know, this is a foundational step. It's a fundamental step, a basic, or you might say this is a radical step. It starts with a decision. But if you want to learn to be an apprentice to Jesus, you enter into training in the ways of the kingdom. It's not something that just magically happens with a decision or a ritual. It's something like anything else we do, it's something that we train for, that we learn the ways of that kind of thing. It's a fundamental step, that decision to be an apprentice of Jesus, where we're constantly learning from him how to live my life in the kingdom of God. You know, my real life, the one I'm actually living, not just at church or on religious occasions. My whole life, I'm learning to live in the ways of the kingdom. And, you know, as individuals and as a church, we will have many struggles and many battles to fight. But what we need to accomplish anything that Jesus would want us to do in this life, on this earth, involves the quality of life that he makes real in his disciples. Jesus said in John 10:10, I've come that they may have abundant life, life to the full. And he makes life available to us, which allows us to accomplish anything he wants us to accomplish. Like I said, we'll have many struggles, many battles, but one of them shouldn't be a huge gap between the life that he offers and the life that we're actually living. But the good news is he has offered us ways of learning, ways of training, ways of learning to live into the life that he offers. You know, when we're teaching our kids to ride a bike, we don't just teach them that it's good to ride a bike. You know, we don't pull 4 or 5 year olds around and say, listen, you really ought to ride a bike. You know, I'm thinking I want to learn to ride a bike. Good, because you're in big trouble if you don't. It's not a matter of teaching them that they should, they ought to, or they're in trouble if they don't. Unfortunately, a lot of the teaching about being a follower of Jesus involves you really ought to be a Christian. You really should. It's a good thing for you to live in the kingdom, or you're really going to be in big trouble on Judgment Day if you don't. But it doesn't necessarily involve in teaching how to do that. But Jesus didn't leave us hanging there. He taught us how to live the full life that he offers, how to live under his reign. In Matthew chapter 5, I guess I ought to turn over there. I was in 2 Chronicles. Yeah. Nothing wrong with 2 Chronicles. Doesn't match my notes. In verse 17, Jesus says, do not think that I've come to abolish the law or the prophets. I've not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them. I tell you the truth, until heaven and earth disappear, not the smallest letter, not the least stroke of a pen will by any means disappear from the law until everything is accomplished. Anyone who breaks one of the least of these commandments and teaches others to do the same will be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever practices and teaches these commands will be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I tell you that unless your righteousness surpasses that of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, you will certainly not enter the kingdom of heaven. So this may be a little bit confusing or not necessarily accessible to us if we don't know what the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees was like. But their approach to life was that we have this list of laws, and if you can just obey all the laws, you're good to go. So for every situation in life, you need a rule, you need a law to go by. And this rule-based ethic, which another word for it is legalism, is something that has an appearance of power, an appearance of authority, but for some reason Jesus says that unless your approach to doing what's right, your approach to living your real life exceeds or surpasses that rule-based ethic, that rule-based approach to life, you won't live under the reign of God. And if you're like me, we've grown up, if you've grown up in the church, you've probably grown up thinking of the Pharisees and scribes as the bad guys, because they opposed Jesus in many things. But they were not the bad guys in this culture. They were the religious elite. They were the ones who were seen as having it all together. They were smart. They were committed. They were passionate about the law. And Jesus says there's something about the way they approach life that can actually keep you from living under the reign of God. If you're looking for a law or a rule to govern your days, your life, that's going to prevent you from living under the reign of God. It's like, why in the world would Jesus say that? Well, first of all, it seems like Jesus really wants to clear something up, because it sounds like when he starts talking about that our approach to living right, our righteousness has to exceed or surpass that of the scribes and Pharisees, and they're all about the law. I think Jesus thought, you know, it's going to sound like I'm saying let's throw the law out. So he said, let's clear that up right up front. I'm not saying throw the law out. I didn't come to throw the law away. I came to fulfill the law. I came to bring you the kind of life that the law was always pointing toward, but actually has no power to give you. So your righteousness has to surpass or exceed that of the scribes and Pharisees if you want to live in the kingdom. And if we miss what Jesus meant by this, then we miss his teaching on how to break out of the patterns of sin that are in our lives and to live into the kingdom vision. Why would Jesus say our righteousness has to, our approach to doing what's right has to get beyond legalism? Because ultimately we humans experience law as crushing. We can't live up to it. None of us, if it's all about law, we can't do it. In fact, the New Testament goes on to say that's actually a part of what the law was designed to do, is to teach you that you can't do it, that you need grace, that you need the mercy of God. The law was a school teacher, a pedagogue to bring us to God. But also Jesus says our righteousness has to surpass that of the scribes and Pharisees in order to enter the kingdom, because even when trying to follow the rules, to try to obey the laws, we can still fall into patterns of sin. Again, Jesus says, I'm not doing away with the law, but I'm giving you a new way of approaching it. In, later on in Matthew 22, Jesus is challenged by a lawyer who asks him, you know, what's the greatest command? And Jesus says to love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. And the second greatest command is to love your neighbor as yourself. And Jesus says all the law and the prophets hang on those two commands. So that's, those commands are fundamental to Jesus' approach to living in the kingdom. And so, and Jesus is saying that my way of approaching right living is a love-based ethic as opposed to a law-based ethic. Sin, and also when the command that Jesus says, the two commands to love God and love neighbor are positive things. They're not, it's not something you can't do. Like he goes on and talks about, you know, do not murder, do not commit adultery, those kinds of things. You can't live your life by what you're not going to do. You have to live your life by what you choose to do. And that's fundamental to Jesus' approach. But sin is missing the mark. I grew up thinking of sin as breaking the rule. But sin is actually not just breaking the rule. Sin is missing the mark. It's a hamartano is an archery term. It's like you draw an arrow back and you shoot it and you're aiming for the bullseye. And if you don't hit the bullseye, that's missing the mark. That's sin. So really, sin is when I'm in my actions, in my thinking, in whatever I'm going about, if it doesn't qualify as loving God, heart, soul, mind, and strength, and loving my neighbor as myself, I've missed the mark. But as we're going to see in a minute, Jesus offers us things that we can do to overcome patterns of sin in our lives. It's not just a rule that says this is wrong. He gives us things that we can do, things that we can practice. I call them transforming practices that we can do to break out of the power of sin in our lives. I love the song that we just sang, This is Amazing Grace. It said, who breaks the power of sin and darkness? And the answer is the King of glory, the King above all kings. The good news is Jesus is King. And the good news is he breaks the power of sin and darkness in our lives and gives us ways to come out of it. Something that I also, as we start looking at the teachings of Jesus, that I believe is so important is that Jesus' teachings are realistic and achievable. They're not highly idealistic. They're not some impossible standard that you shoot for, but you know you're never going to get there. Jesus gives us things we actually can do to lead us into the life he wants us to live. By giving us things we can do, Jesus offers us an invitation to participate in the grace of God rather than something intended to shame us with the recognition of our sinfulness. It seems like that's a big approach, part of the religion that I grew up with is one of the fundamental places that you have to start is to understand how bad you are. And in my experience, that's something we all pretty much got down. Anybody in here, if you're here today and you really can't see that you, in like a number of ways, fall short in your life, and what you really need is more shame, we're going to meet right up here, and some of us will just gather around you and help you get in touch with the shame that you need to really buckle down and do what's right. You know, that's actually not how Jesus approached people. He said, I'm going to crush you with your shame. I'm going to beat you into submission. That's what the law the law was the pedagogue or the teacher that was here to convince us that we can't do it on our own. That was the law's role. And Jesus says, if you want to live in the kingdom, you've got to get beyond that. But some people might ask, well, you're talking about things that I have to do. What's this do stuff? I thought we were saved by grace. If it's grace, then I shouldn't have to do anything. This is something that I think is so powerful. These are the words of Dallas Willard that I've used from time to time, but I believe it's so powerful. And that grace is not opposed to action. Grace is opposed to earning. But Jesus gives us things that we can do. We participate in the grace of God by doing the things Jesus calls us to do to break out of the patterns of sin. Grace is not opposed to effort. It's opposed to earning. So let's continue reading. Right after Jesus says, "For I tell you that unless your righteousness surpasses that of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, you will certainly not enter the kingdom of heaven." You've heard that it was said to the people long ago, verse 21, "Do not murder, and if anyone who murders will be subject to judgment. But I tell you that anyone who is angry with his brother will be subject to judgment. Again, anyone who says to his brother, 'Racha,' is answerable to the Sanhedrin. But anyone who says, 'You fool,' will be in danger of the fire of hell. Therefore, if you are offering your gift at the altar and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift there in front of the altar. First go and be reconciled to your brother, then come and offer your gift. Settle matters quickly with your adversary who is taking you to court. Do it while you are still with him on the way, or he may hand you over to the judge, and the judge may hand you over to the officer, and you may be thrown into prison. I tell you the truth, you will not get out until you have paid the last penny." Jesus says, you've heard it said, don't murder, but I say, don't be angry. And this is a pattern that Jesus uses to compare and contrast his approach to right living with the approach of the scribes and Pharisees, which we'll call traditional righteousness. And Jesus says, traditional righteousness says, don't murder. Traditional righteousness says, if you murder, you're in trouble. How many of you like that law? I do. That's an awesome law. And I'm scared right now because only like 17 people in here raised their hands. You're either really brave or you're hiding something. I want all my neighbors to believe in that law. I want you, while I'm preaching, to believe in that law. I want us to embrace that law. Jesus, and again, he's saying, listen, I didn't come to throw the law away. Do not murder is a good law. It's one of the Big Ten. It's a good one. It's solid. It should never go away. But Jesus is saying, here's the deal, though. You can be legalistically righteous and obey that law, but still fall into these vicious cycles, into these patterns of sin, the things that actually lead to murder. But if you're thinking, I'm cool as long as I don't pull the trigger. I'm cool as long as I don't, however you guys do your murders. The ones of you who didn't raise your hand, the ones of you who hate that law, I don't know what you're planning, but even people who obey that law can fall into patterns of sin and engage in the things that actually lead to murder. And then what happens if you get caught in those patterns? Then in a moment of passion, you break the law. because you're not dealing with the heart. You're not dealing with the patterns of sin in your life that lead to people breaking that law. And Jesus says, you've heard it said, don't murder. And it's a good law. It's just not the high water mark in relationships. How's your marriage going? Well, I didn't kill him this week. But the week's young. You know, it's only midday Sunday. You know, how are your kids doing? They're still alive, ain't they? You know, it's not the high water mark for relationships. But Jesus says, you've heard it said, don't murder, but I say, don't be angry. Because that is the root sin that leads to murder. Jesus said, it's not, you're not going to live under the reign of God and live out love to God, heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love to your neighbor as yourself if you're thinking, I'm cool as long as I'm not killing people. That doesn't have the power. To give full life. It doesn't break the power of sin and darkness in your life. You can be a good law keeper and still not be a good person. But he gives some transforming practices, some things that we can do. And they involve realizing the escalating powers of sin that lead to murder. And he says, you know, as kingdom people, as people who live under the reign of God, here's some things we can do. First, verse 22, I tell you, anyone who is angry with his brother will be subject to judgment. Again, anyone who says to his brother, Racha, is answerable to the Sanhedrin. But anyone who says, you fool, will be in danger of the fire of hell. He's talking about name-calling and things that don't really mean much. You know, apparently saying, you fool, was a really big deal to them. It's not as big as big a deal these days. It's not complimentary. But it really meant something bad. And the word racha, it was a term of contempt. And it's like actually pronounced racha. And it sounds like you're going, and that's the thought behind it. It's like, you're garbage. You're just, ugh. You know, I see her, I spit on the ground. I see him, you know. Now, we don't say raka and fool doesn't mean the same thing, but we have our other names, right? We have words. We do the name-calling thing, right? You know, you're such an idiot. You're such a jerk. And I can't use all of them, like, in my sermons. I don't want to be like, oh, the cussing preacher's up this week, you know? But, you know, we just do that at men's retreat. We don't do it here at church. You know? Not really. but you know, those words that you use that you call your wife. That you call your husband. That you call that annoying person at work. Or maybe you don't usually say it to them, but you say it to your coworker about, you know, he's such a... Or that, you know, at least go through your mind. Jesus said, listen, when you start getting angry, you're going to go there, right? But what happens when you start using terms of contempt? You start name-calling. You know, it's one of the big things that we try to teach our kids, you know, no name-calling. We have to learn the power of our words, you know, and our kids, when they're really little, you know, take it seriously. Like, you know, he said the S word. Really? And what's the S word? Shut up. Oh, wow, it's pretty bad. Don't say the S word, you know. He said the B word. Really? What's the B word? But. That's pretty bad. Don't say that, you know. And, you know, and maybe we get it when we're 3 and 4 and 5 that, you know, there's certain words that are so bad you don't even say them. They're the B word or the S word. And we're careful about how we use our words with each other, and then somewhere we lose it. And I think the place we lose it is middle school. Because middle school, even when at your best, middle school trains you to be evil. It's the cattiest, most cliquish, evilest place in the world. And I'm not saying that some of our kids, by the grace of God, don't make it out alive. But we go through life, and there are just phases of life that train us. How to use terms of contempt and insult and name calling with devastating effect. And some of us don't, we've made it all the way into marriage and haven't learned how to break that pattern of sin yet. And it's devastating. Some of us have made it all the way into being parents and haven't learned that you can't call your kids names. I don't care how mad you are. We're kingdom people. We don't do name calling. We don't show contempt for other people. No matter if we disagree with them, we disagree with their ideas, we disagree with their lifestyle, we disagree with their actions, we don't engage in that, because what that is a vicious cycle that becomes a downward spiral. And you know where, unchecked, it leads to? Murder. So we deal with it on the heart level, but we start by saying, we're kingdom people, we don't call names, and we don't show contempt to other people. He goes on, verses 23 and 24, therefore, if you're offering your gift at the altar, and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift there in front of the altar. First go and be reconciled to your brother, then come and offer your gift. And he used this image or this vision from temple worship that we can't relate to at all, because we don't, I'm assuming most of us, at least, don't know what it's like to go to the temple and offer a sacrifice on an altar. But we can probably imagine that it's a pretty solemn, pretty sacred event. Maybe we could relate it to, we're right in the middle of our vows at our wedding ceremony. And we remember that there's another Christian that has something against us. Do you take this, man? Hold up. I'll be right back. And she runs out. And the maid of honor's grabbing her train and kind of, you know. And everybody's, oh, she's running out. And she goes, no, I just remembered. Somebody has something against me, and I'm going to work it out. Then I'll come back with a, you know, do the wedding thing, which sounds ridiculous. And I think probably when Jesus said that, it's like at the altar you run out and get reconciled in a relationship. That's more important than offering my sacrifices to God. And Jesus says, God will be fine. What he's concerned about is your heart. If you remember somebody has something against you, go, we're kingdom people. We're the kind of people
who work things out. We're the kind of people who give it top priority. It's a living reflection of what it means to love God, heart, soul, mind, and strength, and to love your neighbor as yourself. You know, everything that Jesus says, everything hangs on those two. If you can put those into practice, if you can live those out, you'll take care of all the laws. That's the love-based ethic versus a law-based ethic. Verse 25, settle matters quickly. Come to terms quickly. Somebody's taking you to court. It says, on the road, work it out with them. Just in everyday life, listen, don't wait until somebody forces you to work something out with your adversary. See, it's easy. One of the patterns of sin that we can fall into is we know there's something not right between me and somebody. So whether I've wronged them or they've wronged me, but I'm walking around through life and I know it's there, but I'm not dealing with it. And, you know, but if God comes down in the flesh and corners me and makes me deal with it, I'll deal with it then. But if I don't have to, I ain't doing it. You know, if that brother takes me to court, then we'll work it out. Otherwise, forget him. Jesus says, no, we're kingdom people. We live under the reign of God. We go to the other person. We settle matters quickly. We're the kind of people who resolve things. It's so rare out there. Unfortunately, it can be so rare in here. It can be so rare in here. As kingdom people, we refuse to participate in name-calling in terms of contempt. We make reconciliation and restoration of relationships a top priority. And we come to terms quickly. We say, I will be the one who will initiate reconciliation. So that when I start getting angry, the thing that what comes up when I start getting angry is not, well, I didn't kill him, so I'm cool. We say, no, Jesus said, I don't call names. I don't show contempt. I work things out. That's who I am. That's my path into full life. That's my way into kingdom living, living under the reign of God. And we are becoming that kind of people. Because Jesus didn't just say, you ought to live in the kingdom. You're in really big trouble if you don't live in the kingdom. No, he taught us how to live in the kingdom. He gave us practical things we can do and to not do so that we live in those ways. And something I want to note in closing here is the importance of this three-phased approach. We see traditional righteousness, the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, that Jesus says you got to get beyond that legalistic approach. And then we also see it's a matter of identifying patterns of sin, vicious cycles that we can fall into, even when we're obeying the rules, the laws. But then to see the transforming practices that Jesus gives us to follow. An approach to even Jesus' teachings on sin is a two thing. Like, you've heard it said, but I tell you. And if you think of it just in that way and don't go deeper into what Jesus is saying to do, you can actually make Jesus' approach to right living more burdensome than the law. and it comes out something like this. You've heard it said, don't murder, or you go to hell. Jesus said, don't be angry, or you go to hell. And you go, I'm going to hell. I'm just flat going to hell. So Jesus takes, if you think of it that way, what you do is you take, Jesus takes a very, very challenging command and makes it an impossible one. And some of us heard this recently. A few of us went to the Catalyst Conference, and there we heard a guy preach who leads a little church over in Alpharetta called North Point Church. Andy Stanley, you might have heard of him. He leads one of the biggest churches anywhere. And there are plenty of people out there that are Andy Stanley haters. Got any here? No, I'm just kidding. I'm not one of them. I actually think he's an amazing communicator, and he is a very focused leader. I have a lot of respect for him. But he was teaching about this, and his point was that Jesus sets an impossibly high standard that no one can meet. And I think what he's trying to get at is it drives us to understand that we have to have grace. I think he's a lot better leader and preacher than I am, and so I say this with a little bit of fear and trembling and humility and all that, and I'm a fan, Andy, and all that, you know. He probably won't listen to this recording, but I think in that area, he is precisely wrong. The Bible says it's the role of the law to show us we can't do it on our own. Jesus didn't come along and make it way harder so we really, really, really understand what scum we are. That's not how Jesus interacted with people. Jesus didn't downplay the seriousness of sin, but he gave us things that we can do to break the power of sin. And we're going to talk further about this next week. But I believe it doesn't have to. Either way, Jesus said the same things, but it's a matter of understanding how to approach these teachings. I believe that Jesus gave us a pathway to life, not a hammer to polarize us into death. He gave us a pathway into life, and his teachings are realistic. One, they're realistic about the fact that we struggle with sin. But they are realistic and achievable. They're not high ideals that nobody could ever do. They're things that we can do to participate in the grace of God. I just want to, I think it would be a really healthy thing for us to think about just this one teaching of Jesus that we talked about today. You've heard it said, don't murder, but I say, don't be angry. And when you feel yourself getting angry, if you say, I'm not going to call names, I'm not going to show contempt, I'll be the kind of person who makes it a top priority to resolve conflict, and I'll work things out quickly. One teaching of Jesus. What if all of us this week obeyed that one teaching of Jesus? Let's imagine this. This is going to blow your mind even more. Imagine that if everybody in the United States this week obeyed this one teaching of Jesus. First of all, political debates would have to be canceled. But if everybody said, okay, I'm going to obey this one teaching of Jesus. I love to have conversations about this. It takes about 15 seconds for our minds to completely shut down because we would not recognize this world. We would not recognize this world if everybody obeyed one teaching of Jesus. I said last week that that when I start talking about the teachings of Jesus, I just call it the power and brilliance of Jesus. And why do I call it that? Because they're powerful and they're brilliant. So I get real creative and call it the power and brilliance of Jesus. We wouldn't recognize the world if everybody obeyed one. Now, it's our job to go make disciples, baptize them in the name of the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit, and teach them to obey everything Jesus commanded. That's a pretty tall order. We're teaching each other to obey everything Jesus commanded. What if we messed up and we only taught people to obey one teaching of Jesus? It would still change the world.